Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, featuring commentary by Bruno Barron, Amara Enya, Stephanie Hitt, Michael Lotus, and Craig Gilbert. Our program tonight coming to you from our own base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email me a comment, it's brucedumont@museum.tv. If you want to tweet me a comment, it's @Dumo. You can join us on the World Wide Web, audio and video every week. And that is not only tonight's program, but also any show in the past, beyondthebeltway.com. There are 53 days to go before Inauguration Day. There's been a lot of action, obviously, in putting the transition team together. There's going to be a challenge of some votes in Wisconsin and perhaps Michigan and Pennsylvania by Jill Stein. A little bit later on in the program, we're going to get an update report from Craig Gilbert of the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel, and he'll bring us up to date on Jill Stein's effort to have a recount in the state of Wisconsin. She feels there's been some irregularities. We'll talk about that later on in the broadcast. But again, sort of internationally and as it relates to even domestic politics, the big story since we last met was Fidel Castro has died at age 90, and I want to get reaction from everyone as to there's already controversy in the way that Donald Trump has responded to it and the President of the United States has responded to it, and then a lot of people went apoplectic with the way that Justin Trudeau responded to the death of one of the great despots of the 20th century and the 21st century. Let me start with you, Stephanie Hitt. You're our card-carrying Republican. My two-part question to you. What do you make of how we should react to Castro's death? And do you think that should result in a turning back from the policy of President Obama to open up ties with Cuba?
Well, I think first of all, I was very heartened by Donald Trump's reaction. I think the reaction is anyone who is neutral or even favorable towards Fidel Castro doesn't get it. And the other thing is, There are ways that we can interact with Cuba. I've always been a proponent that to the extent that any exposure to Americans, American enthusiasm, exceptionalism, whatever, always will convert the people. So I wouldn't roll things back, but I think we should look to Vietnam maybe as an example of how we interact with Cuba.
I want to follow up on that. Bruno Barron is our card-carrying libertarian. You've been a Trump critic in the past on this program.
Yep.
What's your take on the passing of Fidel Castro?
60 years too late. It's too bad the Bay of Pigs wasn't successful. Would have saved the world an unbelievable, would have saved Cubans an unbelievable amount of suffering. And it's just too bad that things have gone on as long as they have. As for opening Cuba or having openings with Cuba so that they can rejoin the nation, the world of nations moving forward, that's fine up to a point. I'm neutral to slightly negative on the way that the president has done it in the past, but now at least Castro's dead.
Michael Otis is our card-carrying Donald Trump Republican. You were a Donald Trump Republican long before it was fashionable and ratified by the Electoral College. Maybe not popular vote, but you're smiling. You're a happy man.
I have had some friends who weren't happy with me. Hopefully we'll all make up for our...
Your reaction to Castro?
Happy to see a communist tyrant die. And too bad he didn't die in front of a firing squad 55 years ago for the lives he's destroyed. As to the USA and Cuba, Obama was right in a very general way that we should be open up to them, but we did not do it in a way that the communist government didn't control. And we need the American people and the Cuban people in touch with each other, not filtered through the communist tyranny down there in Cuba.
Amara Enya joins us. She is a Bernie Sanders Democrat. Nice to have you back. Your reaction?
My reaction was it is the end of an era. Having had personal family experience with a dictator in Nigeria, I certainly understand what that means with political killings, kidnappings, and all of the things that come with having a dictator. However, I do have a more complex view of his legacy and understanding that, for example, the work that took place on the continent in Africa, the liberation movements against European powers, the aid that was offered to Haiti. There are many people out out there who are also seeing sort of a, it's less of a black and white thing in terms of the legacy that, that Fidel Castro had. And so what I've been more interested in having is more robust conversations about what that legacy looks like, what it means for African Americans, because Cuba housed Assata Shakur, who is a political exile from the United States, one of the Black Panthers. And so it depends on who you speak to. But at the end of the day, I think, you know, there's never been a good dictator, right? And I'm just, you know, the idea of starting off as a freedom fighter and a revolutionary and then sort of devolving into a despot is one that I think is worth exploring in depth.
We should also remember for those young listeners to the program, and once upon a time, I mean, Fidel Castro during the revolution was a big hero in the United States. He was on the Tonight Show with Jack Parr.
Yeah.
He was on television in the United States, had a very good following. In fact, some of the video that you're seeing in recent days, you hear Fidel Castro speaking English. He speaks English fluently, but then, you know, about 55 years ago, he decided, no, I can't speak English anymore. And so you see him fanning the flames again, as the media has reported. He sort of embarrassed 11 presidents of the United States with his stand. It's always been tied to domestic policy as it relates to what happens in the state of Florida. And it also, it basically, you know, it goes back to, you know, the sanctions as a result of actions of the Kennedy administration at the Bay of Pigs. I mean, that's why the Cuban in the United States turned against him. So I want to, again, also, I would just like to say, having visited Cuba last year, the positive side of what I experienced was the education, the health care, infancy mortality, some of the highest or lowest in the world, as you relate to it. The people itself seem to be happy, but they're making $20 a month. That's the average salary, $20 a month. And again, what I was told when I was there, and everyone expected that Castro would die, obviously, soon. They also questioned whether the Cuban people would know about it, because there's virtually no mass communications there. They also reported that Raul, who is 85 years old, that's the younger brother, that there is now a vice president in Cuba. I don't know his name off the top of my head, but they thought that he represented he was someone in his 40s, and they represented, they thought then that the true transformation in Cuba would happen when both Fidel and Raul died.
I think from my perspective, Fidel Castro started on this journey without a clear sense of what the end game was going to look like. And for a lot of revolutionaries, you're sort of building the road as you go along. So you see him evolving, adopting more socialist, more communist mechanisms that related to policies that they implemented.
But when he had U.S. support in the early days, he was not spouting any of that stuff.
Exactly.
That came almost a year after the adulation of a lot of Americans took place, and then we found out what sort of a guy he really was.
Exactly. And I think that evolution, how he evolved over the years, gives insight into how Cuba has developed. And I think it's worth looking into, especially his issues with racial equity, also in Cuba, that he was really a proponent of doing away with segregation. Those are the sorts of things that he did.
A lot of it has to do
with... pause. 1-800-723-8289. Where do you come down on Cuba-American policy? Is it something we should continue, as President Obama believes, or should we pull the plug on any relations with Cuba, at least as they're defined today? 1-800-723-8289. I'm Bruce Dumont from Chicago.
A historic moment from the archives at museum.tv.
Thank you all very much. Admiral Kelly, Captain Card, officers and sailors of the USS Abraham Lincoln, my fellow Americans, major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
Experience more history at museum.tv.
My name is Johnny Carson. My job is to make you laugh.
Johnny Carson brings you TV legends and classic moments every night on Antenna TV.
Don't make fun of me, Johnny.
And now through October, don't miss Here's Johnny, the making of The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. It's a must-see collection of Johnny's stage props, costumes, video, and more. For more info and tickets, go to museum.tv.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Michael Otis, you were going to make a point about domestic policy.
One of the interesting wrinkles here is the tariff on sugar and our ban on, I don't know if it's fully in place anymore, on importing sugar from Cuba, which the rest of the world doesn't do, and the Florida constituency for keeping sugar prices up. So on the one hand, you're going to have expat Cubans and their grandchildren who would like more open relations with Cuba, but there was also the issue that a very strong interest group in Florida in particular is going to get clobbered if we are buying sugar at the world price.
Do you think politically that the president-elect is going to have to maintain the hard line that he has suggested because for fear of turning off, you know, Cubans in Florida, living in Florida?
That's why we've had to do it all these years.
I know.
I guess I'll piggyback on what Mike was saying, particularly since I'm the libertarian on the panel. The sugar tariffs that America has had that has kept American sugar prices as high as they've been for decades is essentially a sop to, like, three or four crony companies. It is one of those areas where the Republicans are complete crony capitalists. The Bushes are dialed into this stuff. They always have been. And it would be very refreshing to see Donald Trump. It would be one of those things that would make me change my opinion toward Trump more positively if he just said, the heck with these tariffs. Of course, he's a tariff guy, so I don't know that he's going to do that. But this is one thing. It's like you just – from a libertarian perspective, there's no rational basis for the sugar tariffs and why Americans should pay 1.5 to twice the amount of money per pound of sugar than the rest of the world does.
But what we have right now, though, I mean, the American corporations, mostly in the hospitality business, they're chomping at the bit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're the ones that are going to make the first wave of those that are making money on there.
Right.
And it seems to me that, you know, a common denominator is American corporations, many multinational corporations, their only concern is making money. They don't care about human rights. They don't care how many people he shot, how many people he put in prison. If they, you know, if they can get a piece and they can open their hotel in Havana, they're going to go for it.
I completely agree with that.
I don't know. Yeah. Not now. But go ahead.
I completely agree with that assessment. And the first thing that I was thinking is what I would like to see is hopefully with a change in leadership in Cuba to see the people begin to determine what they want moving forward in terms of the economy, in terms of how they engage with the United States.
Well, by the way, let's go to Miguel on line 60. I think he has an answer to a question that I posed in the last segment. Miguel, are you there? Miguel, line 6, are you there? He's gone. Oh, go ahead.
Well, you know, here's the interesting thing, and that is, you know, your original question is Trump, whether he's going to have to roll back on some of, and, you know, whether or not he can roll back on some of the things that Obama has set forth. And I think when it comes to, like, the hospitality industry, what's very clear under the relationship established by Obama now is that anyone that goes in there, everything, any money that is made is going to be filtered through the loyalists and the Cubans in charge. It's never going to trickle down to
50,
the people. 50%
of every business in Cuba has to have 50, or all business, 50% of the ownership has to be Cuban.
Correct. But which Cubans? That's the thing. And
the
so right now, it's set up. And I think some of the things that Donald Trump is saying is, look, I'll continue to do some of these things if, in return, you show me that there are going to be freedoms, that people are going to be able to work. They're going to be able to set up exterior businesses and so on.
Well,
so I think
Castro
he can
has,
do it by keep, and still keep it open.
Raul Castro has already taken some steps in that direction, talking about how they're opening the economy more. I actually think the best strategy for the president is to not rush into anything with Cuba, to not hastily roll back all of these steps that President Obama has taken, to let things play out and see how they're playing out and then move strategically.
It's also interesting that we have in Cuba, we have a classic case of a country whose first and most obvious business enterprises are tourism.
Right.
It's casinos, it's hotels, it's all the things that Donald Trump knows. And you're right, if he wasn't president-elect of the United States,
he'd be ruling Cuba.
He'd be developing Cuba. Up business opportunities.
Brings up the issues of the fact that he's refused to die, at least at this point in time, he is not divested or has said he's not going to divest in his business interest, which I understand. And from his perspective, it's not the same as being Michael Bloomberg, where you own a bunch of stocks in a specific media company. The way his media company, the way his money is set up, if he were forced to divest of it, he would have to sell all of it, you know, very quickly at fire sale prices. So I can understand the hesitancy there. But the interesting thing is family connections and the way his kids are running the empire. Who's to say they're, you know, I mean, was he going to recuse himself from bidding on, you know, Cuban properties?
Well, what do you think? I mean, let's tackle the issue.
Well, I think it's
I'm going to ask Amara a what if question, because you've been critical of Donald Trump.
Yes.
To say the least. If Donald Trump divested of everything, it would take a long time to do it. If he divested of anything, would people on your side of the political spectrum give him some credit for doing it?
I would. I would give him a lot of credit for divesting, which I think he should do. I simply think it is unacceptable to have such vast business interests and to simultaneously be president of the United States. I think that it is merging corporate interests with U.S. government, which sometimes are at odds with each other. If he divested of all of his business interests, not just saying, well, I don't care about my business, my kids are running it, that's not enough. I would actually give him credit.
Michael, for this entire campaign, you knew that if Donald Trump got elected, this issue would come up.
Sure.
Where do you come down on it?
I have to think he's getting some very expensive and comprehensive legal advice right now about what he's required to do and what steps he might take to ease back. And he can't do it overnight. We haven't elected a guy who
right.
would be like if we elected John D. Rockefeller 100 years ago. We've never seen anything like this.
Right.
He's certainly not going to destroy his business to be president. So I think the best thing for him to do is at some point reasonably soon articulate what process he's going to follow and say why this is, you know, complies with the law and do it in an open way. But I don't know exactly how he's going
to do
it.
I actually think to ask him to liquidate is almost absurd. It's the way he owns his business.
It would be a fire sale.
And the other thing is, it is, in many ways, it is him. It is his business. It's not like he's leaving a company where he happened to be another principal. I mean, the Trump Corporation, it is him. It's who he is.
But he willingly ran for president of the United States. And you take that into consideration. And legally speaking, we even talk about the appearance of impropriety.
Yeah. But the
that
thing
has to
is,
be taken into consideration there,
I don't
as
think
well.
There's any – I think that he can very clearly step down from his role in the business and – and I don't think he has to divest himself because that is him, and that he can turn that over to his kids, and he just says for the next 4 years or eight, I am no longer involved in the
business.
But
he turns it over to his children, and then he's in private meetings
with
the Prime Minister of Japan.
We've never asked another president to have their
family members. He's meeting with Prime Minister of Japan with his two children, Jared and Ivanka, in the same meeting who do not have security clearance. So, again, the appearance of impropriety.
We don't know how that's going to pan out.
Isn't this the same appearance of impropriety that he and yours truly and everybody around this table – criticized Hillary Clinton for with
yes.
the foundation.
Exactly.
Yes.
The number of donations to the Clinton Foundation, they're down 87%. So I'm wondering, who are the 13% that are still contributing
right.
to that foundation?
But somebody said
the other day that the diplomats of the world were being encouraged. There was no evidence to the charge,
right.
obviously, as there frequently isn't, that they were being encouraged to stay at the new Trump Hotel. Well, I've got to tell you, if you're doing business or you're a diplomat, you stay at generally a very nice hotel. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to know that if you stay at a hotel that is owned by the family of the President of the United States, that just might help you someday. And much of what lobbyists do is they do things with false generosity, thinking that, you know, if I do this, I might get a favor someday.
Curry favor.
Everyone.
Yes.
I don't care whether you're a Republican, Democrat, liberal, or conservative. If you give money to a candidate, that's you. One of the reasons why you do that is you're doing it because you think that guy or that woman is going to help you somewhere down the road. whether you're staying at their hotel, buying tickets to their daughter's, recital,
Girl Scout cookies, their wedding.
I guess where I would wonder about that is, to me, I'm more worried about like the big contracts for land deals for like a deal in Cuba or something like that. The fact of the matter is, Donald Trump isn't going to get that much richer or that much poorer if the entourage from from Germany or Italy stays in a Trump hotel or stays at like a Lowe's or something like that. Or I'm trying to think of another fancy property. Lowe's probably isn't it, but or the Waldorf Astoria. So I'm more worried about like the contract deals and the kind of things that might go on under the table that nobody really knows about until 3 or 4 years have gone by, and then all of a sudden all kinds of people have gotten rich.
I think Donald Trump is going to be very able to separate himself and build those, China, excuse the reference to building a wall, but they do law firms do this, banks, companies do this all the time, where they can build walls to separate those deals and those people that are negotiating those deals from what Donald Trump is doing.
I'll venture a prediction. Whatever he does, he'll be aggressively and perpetually criticized by the people on the other side, and the people at his own side don't like him. How he ends up structuring this, my guess is it will be something fairly kind of handcrafted and specific, maybe even for different parts of the business. He's got a licensing arm that's lucrative. He's got properties that he has different degrees of interest in. Some he may sell. I'm guessing that what you're going to end up with is a something more complex than
we're
talking about.
I'm going to make another prediction. No matter what he does, no matter how far he goes, if he goes way down the road, it's not going to satisfy the national news media or the Democrats, because they have constantly had a focus on an issue. And again, it's very similar, in my view, to some of the things that he was talking about and a lot of people were talking about with Hillary Clinton. 1-800-723-8029. When we come back, we've got Birmingham, Alabama on the line. We will hear from them. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks for joining us tonight.
If you look hard enough, go off the beaten track far enough, you'll find an America teeming with the unusual, the odd, the downright strange.
I'm Will Klinger, and I'm your guide on a package tour we like to call
Wild Travels.
Join me for a new season of Wild Travels, Sundays at 10:30 p.m. on WTTW Channel 11.
The Museum of Broadcast Communications is Chicago's perfect place for senior citizens. Enjoy a stroll down memory lane. Reminisce as museum artifacts, photos, and classic TV shows trigger recollections from your childhood. Enjoy the TLC you'll receive from our expert tour guides. Discounts for groups of 20 or more. Schedule yours right now at museum.tv or call 312-245-8200. Plan your fun trip now at the Museum of Broadcast Communications.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Let's go to call. Richard is calling from Birmingham. Is that Alabama or Michigan, Richard? You're listening to us on Sirius.
Yeah, that's Alabama.
Alabama. Okay.
That's right. Listen, real quick, I got a better connection. I wanted to get it before I drop off. What I want to be sure of is that he could have a blind trust set up with somebody with impeccable business credentials, like Jack Welch or Warren Buffett, and not his kids, to run the show. And that would solve the problem. He doesn't have to divest himself. He simply has to have no way to run it himself or through his kids. Why wouldn't that be a good way to approach it?
First of all, I don't know that Donald Trump would want to let his money be managed by Warren Buffett. He might get out of the presidency flat broke, Warren Buffett. That was me just trying to be humorous. It's a pretty good idea. The issue with the blind trust is it's a lot easier to do when somebody is very wealthy with stocks and bonds and financial instruments, but when it's licensing agreements and golf courses and hotel properties, it's a little bit harder to do that.
Right.
But you're on the right track, and I think Mike addressed it earlier.
And it's the name, too. You remember, his company, it is his name. It's his name. It's his face. It's his image. It's not like it's a name that isn't completely associated with him and his family.
And like Bruno was saying, one day
he will die.
Well, sure.
And that Trump thing will go on. Right. So it's not just... Only him. but it will be the Trump properties after he is long gone.
The kind of businesses he has are much more hands-on kind of businesses. You know, luxury hotels and golf courses, you have to be meticulous about that all day, every day. It's not a passive-type investment. So to find a team of people to turn his businesses over, they have to be very careful to make sure they get the right people. Now, does the business talent exist in America who would do it? I'm sure it does, but you're not going to do this overnight.
But also with his children, I mean, this could also be solved by just keeping his children either 100% business, having nothing to do with government, or if you want them in government, then put them in government, and then they can't have any interest
in
business.
But there's a conflict of interest to have them in government. You can't have them in certain positions of government.
Right. So he would. So honoring the ethical considerations, but you cannot have where your two children are sitting in meetings with the prime minister, and it's unclear as to whether they're performing a government function as advisors or the business function.
I think how he handles the son-in-law Kushner, who seems to be very close, like a close advisor and a very smart guy, that could be some benefit to him. I mean, the point is, you're asking him basically a man to say, you know, the people that you trust more than anybody in the world, you can't trust them anymore. I mean, I think that's too much to ask.
Well, it's not saying that you can't trust them. It's just saying that you have to be very clear about the role that they play now.
Amara's making a good point, but I think Bruce's point is the more clear one, is that you're basically this is the whole thing about the Chinese wall. We're going to build a Chinese wall between X and Y. Well, when it comes to family and advice and advisors, I mean, it's like expecting Hillary Clinton or Bill Clinton to like show up at Christmas dinner with Chelsea and not talk about what's going on in the world or what was happening had Hillary won. They're family. And you spend a lot of time with them. And this would be true whether there was a Trump empire or not a Trump empire. And they're going to become tacit advisors up to a point, and they're going to know things.
Right, but that was also the case when they were meeting again with the Prime Minister of Japan, and you had the children in the room, and the picture was leaked but on the Japanese side to the press. So the question is, what was being discussed in that meeting? And so, yes, as family, it's not like they're excommunicating their children.
Well, they basically said that it was more of a perfunctory meeting, but we don't know that because we weren't there.
And at that point,
I believe the same thing would have happened to a lesser degree because the assets are different. The same thing would have happened had Hillary Clinton been elected.
Definitely.
As it relates to, well, what's Bill Clinton doing and what's Chelsea doing?
Yes.
Right, and the foundation, although they had suggested they were going to wind that down. But
and I would have had the same kind of critique if Hillary Clinton had won, because there were all of these questions that we brought up about how they handled the foundation.
Speaking of how we're going to handle the foundation and the country and the future and Donald Trump, let's talk a little bit, before we go back to calls, let's talk a little bit about the cabinet decisions that have been made thus far. And let's talk about the one first that hasn't been made, and that is whether it is going to be Romney or whether it is going to be Rudy Giuliani or perhaps a dark horse candidate for Secretary of State. As the card-carrying Trumpster, what do you think of that choice, and what will it tell the world and his supporters based on the decision that Donald Trump makes?
I thought him meeting with Mitt Romney purportedly to possibly make him Secretary of State was a strange decision. Romney chose not to back him and was pretty hostile even after he was nominated throughout. Now, as far as just a kind of olive branch to the Republican establishment, maybe that's what the point of that meeting was. Now we have this sort of series of tweets from Kellyanne Conway suggesting that there's this groundswell against Romney. So, you know, trying to parse through these signals, I don't know what it means. I tend to think he's not going to get the job.
What does it mean to you, and how do you feel about Romney?
Well, you know,
versus Rudy versus somebody else.
Well,
John Bolton.
I strongly believe, actually, I think John Bolton would be the strongest candidate of those three because of his experience. And Giuliani, one of the things that I've noticed over these last few weeks as people are come into the picture as possible candidates is Trump does seem to have a real problem with anyone that promotes themselves. And we saw that a little bit with Newt Gingrich.
Irony.
We saw that with Chris Christie. I mean, it's one thing to be loyal, but I mean, the way he sort of put Chris Christie to the side and so on one of the things that Giuliani was the first one on board, I think, one of the very first ones on board. And he was really the first person to give true legitimacy to Trump as a candidate. I strongly believe that.
I agree with that.
And I do believe that he does whether Giuliani's promoting himself out there or not, I do believe that he does owe Giuliani a special place in his administration.
I agree.
Whether it's Secretary of State or whatever. You know, I don't know Giuliani's temperament, really, as Secretary of State.
Online Hill headline today said, and I checked it just before I left, but it said somebody named Tulsi Gabbard
from Hawaii,
yes, is going to be the Secretary of State pick. Mm.
And
so,
she's a Democrat,
and
yes,
and she's
so
a liberal Democrat,
and a Bernie Sanders
Democrat.
Yes,
right. All right, okay.
So fascinating thing about that is that look, Trump has been unpredictable throughout, and when he has been unpredictable, he has been generally successful. If you're looking at what he's doing through, and I've been one of his biggest critics, and I still think that there's a very strong chance that everything falls apart, hell in a handbasket, if he makes the wrong decisions. But he has been handling, in my opinion, he has been a different person post-election than pre-election. And he is doing exactly what many of his supporters predicted he would do, which is, in a businesslike fashion, go through the people, go through layers of talent and looking at things. And perhaps he just called up Mitt Romney because Mitt Romney is a fantastic administrator who knows how to get things done, and maybe he asked Romney for advice.
Here's my assessment of why he went to Mitt Romney. First of all, he knew that it would dominate news. People would show him being magnanimous against the most, I think, most vicious statements made publicly by certainly anybody with credibility. And by doing it, in his heart, knowing that he's never going to pick Romney, he basically checkmates Romney. Because now if Romney comes out and criticizes Trump, it's going to look like he criticized Trump because he didn't get the job of Secretary of State. Basically, I think he lured him in, he put him in a corner, and he has neutralized him. And again, especially, I agree with you about Giuliani. Giuliani probably probably has more baggage than an Amtrak train, and probably would have difficulty going through confirmation. Although he is the most loyal, loyalty is important. And I would hope that Romney would get something. But, you know, Newt Gingrich basically said that he's sort of stepping aside. He wants to be a senior advisor. Because I don't think Newt would want to go through confirmation hearings either.
No.
I think these guys are making too much money. They can be on any show at any time. So they've got their ego fed, and they want to keep their ability to raise money.
I think the ego part is important. I think Giuliani has a bit of an ego. I think Newt Gingrich has a huge ego. And they do sometimes put... they're out there for themselves as much for Trump. And I do think that's a very important thing, that Trump is very much about putting the job and his mission first. I mean, I watched those Celebrity Apprentice shows years ago. I mean, I had little babies at the time. I watched a lot of reality TV. And one of the things that he does, he has an amazing skill at finding interesting talent in different places. But he also believes strongly that people put the mission first. And that was very clear.
I want to go back to the congresswoman from Hawaii.
Yes.
If he were to go that way, that would be a shocker that could, I think, hurt him with his core base.
It would be. I think it would be. I mean, it would be fascinating if he picked Tulsi Gabbard, who I'm a big fan of Tulsi Gabbard. But I also think it might go a long way to mending some of the rifts and chasms in the country post-election. So it could be a symbolic move. I do think for Secretary of State, I would be very, very concerned about a Giuliani as Secretary of State. I think temperament is very important when it comes to international affairs and diplomatic relations, and I don't think that he has that. He certainly can fit some other role in the administration. I also don't know that Romney, I actually think your assessment is valid. I don't think that he'll give Romney that position. Maybe something else, another token in the administration.
I don't think that Tulsi Gabbard pick, assuming it emerges, would hurt him with his base. She is against the type of nation building and we've been engaged in.
Yes.
I believe she's a military veteran as well.
Yes, she is.
And for her to come in and be credible on that side, vice a guy like John Bolton, who supported all the activities. We can talk about experience, but Trump ran against 16 years of American military policy.
Let's also remember one other thing, and people are going to hate me for what I'm about to say. She's an attractive woman. That goes a long way with the president-elect back shortly from Chicago.
The beauty of Amlink's interior landscape is that we can come in, work with your budget, and create a fit that makes sense for your facility at that time. Our goal is to create foliage designs that not only look incredible the day we put them in, but you can go back 2 years later and it is still maintained and has grown as a perfect fit for that customer's environment.
Call Amlinks now at 888-880-TREE.
A historic moment from the archives at museum.tv.
There can be no stable and enduring peace without the participation of the People's Republic of China and its 750 million people. That is why I have undertaken initiatives in several areas to open the door for more normal relations between our two countries.
Experience more history at museum.tv.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. And Mike, let's talk about some of the other appointments that have been made, and let's get your assessment of them.
Well, he had to give something to Jeff Sessions. Sessions as the attorney general, I think, is a strong pick. There's been some effort to paint him as, you know, a racist and a bad guy. He's one of the few people who actually managed to put a Klansman to death. So I think he's strong on that, or he was participated in that. The Reince Priebus and Steve Bannon combination in the White House is very interesting.
Good combo.
One guy's a strong insider, ties to Paul Ryan, whereas the other guy's kind of the new media type of, you know, radical, if you will. So we get a kind of a balance there. Flynn, General Flynn, you see mixed things about Flynn, but people I know who know him say he's a very smart guy. He'll do a good job. What's her name?
CIA director.
Yeah. Pompeo. Yeah. I don't know that much about him. He's kind of a Tea Party Republican. One thing libertarians...
Number one in his class at West Point.
Oh, smart guy. Went to Harvard Law School. Yeah. Bright guy for sure. He is pretty hardcore for the Patriot Act and some of the surveillance, so the more libertarian side is going to be unhappy with that. Was it Lynn DeVos? What's her name?
Betsy DeVos, the education.
Yeah. She is a serious, choice, school choice.
I want to get Bruno's response because that's your topic.
I've met Betsy DeVos, or I don't know if it's pronounced DeVos or DeVos, but I've met her. I've worked closely with all of the umbrella organizations that she gave. I mean, she was a donor to a great number of school choice organizations, and I was with Heartland at the time. And she's clearly 100% pro-voucher, 100% pro-charter. She's been accused by some of being pro-Common Core because she didn't denounce it aggressively enough, maybe, perhaps. And I'm not a fan of Common Core. I don't know 100% whether she is, but I will tell you this. That pick puts a shot across the bow of the government education complex and the school district system and says that there's a new sheriff in town.
Could that pick have the most difficulty in getting confirmation?
It could. I mean, let's put it this way. If I were a smart Democrat, and I know some smart Democrats, many of them I've met here on your show, I would be really, really scared of a Trump presidency right now because this guy is not doing anything. He's being... Not only is he being unpredictable, but he's being unpredictable more in all kinds of positive ways. Maybe what's he done bad since the election? Maybe tweeting out to the Hamilton cast was a bad thing. Everything else has been strategic at a level that I'll bet most Democrats didn't expect. And when you look forward and see what kind of things this guy could do in fracking the electorate and breaking things away from this hardcore conservative to the hardcore progressive, he may really, really shift the balance of the electorate over 4 years and 8 years.
And that's the brilliance of Steve Bannon. I think that's the fingerprint of Steve Bannon. I want to get your reaction because when Jeff Sessions' name was mentioned, I could feel your blood pressure going up a bit.
Well, I mean, there are just some issues with some of the appointments. With Steve Bannon, I mean, he represents the alt-right. I just don't think that we can overlook strategically within the administration. That's one conversation. But in terms of how this will affect the country and the perception of the administration, that's also to be taken into consideration. So there's a lot of concern about Steve Bannon. The attorney general selection
But just in the wake of what Bruno just said, What about when you put the when you look at the whole mix? Yeah, you got a Steve Bannon in there, but maybe you might have, you know, a liberal Secretary of State, or you might have some of these other things. It is sort of a mishmash.
Well, it is, and there is something to be said about how he's picking. And I don't take anything away from the assertion that he's being very strategic and not as predictable as I think many people had thought. However, a concern, for example, with Jeff Sessions is that there are a lot of ongoing cases, especially right here in Chicago, with U.S. Department of Justice investigation into police brutality and misconduct. What happens with those ongoing investigations under Jeff Sessions? Are they canceled out? With Betsy DeVos as Secretary of Education, we have here in Chicago some major issues with charter schools, with the number of expulsions in charter schools, with the lack of accountability. And so what does her pick mean for policies that are coming from the federal government as it relates to charter schools, charter school proliferation, and school choice? So these are major concerns that people have more on policy.
Well, one of the things I think we're starting to see, and you're touching on it, and it's something that I've sort of been watching very closely, and that is he hit a very, very strong nerve, especially the last few months of his candidacy, of going into the inner cities. And you're touching on some issues that very much affect inner cities, like police brutality, education, voucher systems. I would not be surprised if we start to see something emerging from this president. He might even create a position that somehow starts to address some of the inner city issues that we have. And it would be in conjunction with things like police brutality, and education.
He had the head of BET there the other day,
exactly,
suggesting that he could be an advisor on issues of economic development and enhancement
in the inner cities. Going to see, unlike President Obama, who we felt did have the bully pulpit for that, I think we're going to. I don't think that he's going to abandon the interest in revitalizing and fixing some of these inner city problems. And I think we're starting to see that. I think that is a positive thing. I think it's unique, and it's going to come from several different sides.
The bully pulpit is now the bully tweet.
Yeah.
The election night, when he came out, the first thing he said was talking about African Americans. And that was the first thing. He had a litany, but that's what he started with. If I was the Democrats, I would be scared, because if you are relying a 90% of a population voting for you every election in the bag, and Trump's going to attack that and start to improve the schools and improve safety and improve jobs, and he gets that to 20 or 30 or 40 for the Republicans, the Democrats are in a really bad place, and maybe we'll finally see some progress for people who need some help.
I don't discount that at all. I think one of the things that has come out in this election and even the previous election is the fact that the status quo has simply not worked. And I think that sentiment is what propelled Bernie Sanders, and it's also propelled Donald Trump. And so I'm not discounting the fact that the possibility of him being able to come in and shake up the status quo in a way that can be beneficial. We just have to see how that plays out. I do think there's an opportunity there.
A lot of opportunities. In the next hour, when we return, we're going to bring Craig Gilbert into the conversation. He's the Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and he's going to be talking about the recount, Jill Stein's attempt to recount the votes in Wisconsin and perhaps other states as well. We'll hear from him and also talk more about politics and other cabinet positions. You may have some favorites when we continue from Chicago. I'm Bruce Dumont.
Everyone loves vacationing in Florida, so why not experience it as it was meant to be, where turquoise Gulf waters meet tranquil island beaches. Feel the powder-soft sand between your toes. Revel in a glorious island sunset. Shop the boutiques of a seaside village. Ride horseback along tranquil waters. This is Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Real, authentic Florida, where you can discover an intimate downtown and sip cappuccino at a sidewalk cafe. Catch fresh fish for dinner. Even tour a working winery. Just minutes from all the rest Florida has to offer. Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Plan your visit online at BradentonGulfIslands.com. That's BradentonGulfIslands.com.
The beauty of Amlinks Interior Landscape is that we can come in, work with your budget, and create a fit that makes sense for your facility at that time. Our goal is to create foliage designs that not only look incredible the day we put them in, but you can go back 2 years later and it is still maintained and has grown as a perfect fit for that customer's environment.
Call Amlings now at 888-880-TREE.
If you look hard enough, go off the beaten track far enough, you'll find an America teeming with the unusual, the odd, the downright strange.
I'm Will Klinger, and I'm your guide on a package tour we like to call
Wild Travels.
Join me for a new season of Wild Travels, Sundays at 10:30 p.m. on WTTW Channel 11.
My name is Johnny Carson. My job is to make you laugh.
Johnny Carson brings you TV legends and classic moments every night.
Don't make fun of me, Johnny.
And now through October, don't miss Here's Johnny, the making of The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. It's a must-see collection of Johnny's stage props, costumes, video, and more. For more info and tickets, go to museum.tv.
A historic moment from the archives at museum.tv.
I did not have sexual relations with that woman, Miss Lewinsky. I never told anybody to lie, not a single time, never. These allegations are false, and I need to go back to work for the American people. Thank you.
Experience more history at museum.tv.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. The fat lady may have spoken, but Jill Stein isn't quite ready to accept that Donald Trump is the president-elect of the United States. And joining us to talk about that is an old friend of this program, Craig Gilbert. He is the Washington Bureau Chief of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Craig, nice to have you with us.
Nice to be with you.
We have reached out to you because in the last 3 or 4 days, Jill Stein has said that she wants to challenge election results. Possibly in 3 states, but most notably in Wisconsin. And I want to get a sense from you as to what are the rules up there? What is the likelihood of there being a shift? And tell us what's happening on the ground up there.
Well, so, you know, as much interest as there is in this, it doesn't feel like there's really all that much at stake. I mean, the possibility of this affecting the outcome in Wisconsin is just deeply improbable. We're talking about right now a difference of 22,000 votes, roughly speaking, which is about 0.75 percentage point between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton in Wisconsin. And you know, the last time there was a major recount in Wisconsin was a big attention-getting judicial race back during the Walker, kind of right before the Walker recall wars, and it changed about 300 votes, I think, and that was. That was a big turnout. It was about half as many people as voted for president, but it was still over a million, well over a million people. And so, you know, given everything we know about the election system in Wisconsin, you're just not going to see much change in the numbers.
And also, it seems to me that she seems to be basing the reason of the recount on the possibility that there may have been hacking or skullduggery to some extent. Is that the main reason, or does she have some mathematical reasons?
Yeah, I mean, she's also talked about the exit polls. You know, people look at the exit polls and they wonder why the final results don't match up with the exit polls. And I think, you know, as you know, and many listeners would know who followed kind of the exit poll story over the years, that's really not how the exit polls are supposed to be used. I mean, they are used as a tool for analyzing the election. And in fact, the exit polls are corrected on election night on the basis of the actual vote, right. Not the other way around. There was some chatter from critics of the election process about whether there were irregularities involved in the different voting systems used in Wisconsin. There's really no evidence for that. Wisconsin is one of those states that's actually almost unique in the fact that the elections are administered at the town and city and village level. So there's like almost 2,000
de facto election clerks in the state of Wisconsin. It's very hard. It's so decentralized, it would be extremely hard to manipulate the voting.
When you look at and assess this campaign, as I'm sure you have already probably done several stories on it, have you received an answer from the Clinton campaign as to why they never chose to campaign in Wisconsin?
No, not really. I think they, you know, they thought their lead was safe in the state. And, you know, it's funny because even at the end, even the Trump campaign, which had come multiple times to Wisconsin, canceled its final event in Wisconsin.
Right.
To go to Michigan and Minnesota, which seemed to be a signal from them that they didn't have great expectations of winning Wisconsin either. But clearly, you know, in retrospect, it was a mistake. Not just for her not to campaign in Wisconsin. I mean, she could have brought the president or the first lady in there. Mm-hmm. They could have certainly done more television advertising. Mm-hmm. You know, whenever the you know, even though the election is not close enough, I think, to be affected by a recount, it was close enough to be subject to a lot of second guessing and to imagine a whole bunch of things figuring in the outcome.
When you were last on the program, it was the Sunday before the election. We were doing the show live from Carthage College. You were kind enough to be on the broadcast that evening. In fact, the news you broke that night was that Donald Trump had canceled his appearance that night, which for the reasons you just stated. But virtually, I had about a 50-50 split between those people around my table, who thought that Donald Trump could be elected president versus Hillary Clinton. Nobody predicted that he would win the state of Wisconsin. These were all Wisconsin residents. So
right.
I guess my question to you is, one piece of analysis that I have read as to why Wisconsin did flip for the first time in 25 years was that Paul Ryan had been, and by the way, it was also predicted that Russ Feingold would beat Ron Johnson. But one piece of analysis that I have read is that it was Paul Ryan going around the state with Ron Johnson, getting out the vote for Ron Johnson. And by the way, he is the one responsible for bringing in people to vote for Donald Trump. And obviously, he hasn't gotten too much credit for it. But do you see some credibility in that analysis?
You know, I'm a little skeptical of that just because if you look at the fact I've spent some time in the last several days comparing the Senate vote at the local level, the county and local level, mm-hmm. to the presidential vote. And there were parts of the state where Ron Johnson did outperform Donald Trump, particularly, you know, the Republican suburbs of Milwaukee where, mm-hmm. where Trump was weak. And we talked about that, I think, when I was on your program. But the majority of counties, Trump actually outperformed Ron Johnson. So, you know, I think Ron Johnson both overcame the Trump factor in southeastern Wisconsin and outperformed Trump and probably benefited from Trump's popularity or Trump's performance mm-hmm. in outstate Wisconsin. There are more than 40 counties where Trump did better than Johnson. So I don't think you can say in those counties that that Johnson dragged Trump over the finish line because Trump actually did better than Johnson in those places. I think it was a little bit more complicated than that.
Well, the power and influence of Wisconsin obviously will be great in the future with the president-elect selecting Rance Priebus from Wisconsin to be his chief of staff, and obviously Paul Ryan remaining as the Speaker of the House. Another Wisconsin-related name that a lot of people who watch television know, and that is David Clark, the sheriff of Milwaukee County. Tell us a little, again, we know him to be a sort of a flamboyant, he's great with making phrases.
Right.
But what is the level of respect that he has within the state of Wisconsin?
Well, he's just a hugely controversial figure. I mean, he's not necessarily well known to a lot of people outside Milwaukee. He's the Milwaukee County Sheriff. The Milwaukee County Sheriff is responsible for the jail in Milwaukee County and also for some law enforcement, but the vast majority of law enforcement in Milwaukee County is done at the local level. So he's had tremendous visibility because of his time on television and obviously being a surrogate for Donald Trump and also because of attention for saying really controversial things.
Right.
So he's kind of a lightning rod. People who, if you know about him or have heard of him, those people are probably pretty divided in their opinions about him. You can guarantee that he would be a kind of one of those people that pops up in the headlines from time to time. And then just to throw out one more Wisconsin name at you, mm-hmm. on top of the sure. ones you mentioned, is, you know, on his short list for the Supreme Court, Diane Sykes, who is a federal appellate judge at the Seventh Circuit of Chicago, a former state judge, and who has been mentioned multiple times by Trump as a potential Supreme Court candidate.
Craig, listen, thanks very much for joining us tonight. I predict that in the next 4 years, there's going to be a lot of Wisconsin-centric news that we'll be breaking. We thank you very much for always being available to take our call and share your thoughts with our national audience on Beyond the Beltway. Thanks very much for being with us. I'm Bruce Dumont, back shortly from Chicago.
A historic moment from the archives at museum.tv.
Thank you all very much, Admiral Kelly, Captain Card, officers and sailors of the USS Abraham Lincoln, my fellow Americans. Major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
Experience more history at museum.tv.
My name is Johnny Carson. My job is to make you laugh.
Johnny Carson brings you TV legends and classic moments every night on Antenna TV.
Don't make fun of me, John.
And now through October, don't miss Here's Johnny, the making of The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. It's a must-see collection of Johnny's stage props, costumes, video, and more. For more info and tickets, go to museum.tv.
All right, we're back on. We've just appointed, who do we, Justice Sykes, the...
Diane Sykes.
And you asked the question, let's share the audience. You asked the question, is Diane Sykes, who, again, has just been mentioned as a possible Supreme Court justice, that was one of the names on his list of 21 appointees. You asked if she was married to Charlie Sykes, the talk show host.
Right.
Who was very critical of Donald Trump.
Right. And it turns out, I guess, from other people pulling up their phones, looking at it quickly, that she was married. I guess she was married to Sykes and is now divorced, which, you know, like, that doesn't really necessarily mean anything. But it is fascinating to see. I mean, those of the people who voted for Trump because they were going to change the nature of the establishment, it's kind of interesting how the talk show hosts are married to the judges, who are married to the judges, who are the Speaker of the House of the Senate of the state of Illinois. You know,
do you think Donald Trump would hold it against her if she was divorced?
I would think it would be a little bit ironic.
You're setting that one up there,
you know, but
she's not blonde, however. Yeah.
No, but that she is. Again, going back to the way Trump seems to be operating, he is being very uncanny in his picks, and like I said, if I was a Democrat, I would be very worried right now.
So Judge Judy has a chance.
Well, yeah, I don't know about Judge Judy, but...
Well, but to the point, he had that first list of 10 judges, and he was criticized because I think they were all basically 60-year-old white men.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The second list, I think, was 11. I think he said 21 altogether. It was a much more diverse group. So she may have been on the first one. There may have been one woman on the first one. But I think he'll be sensitive to that because it's going to help him get somebody through the Senate who's... especially if he gets a person of color or a woman, to get the person through the Senate.
Although it's going to be important for that very first one because it is Scalia's seat and because for so many people, the Supreme Court appointment was the reason they voted for Trump, and I think he's aware of that, looking for someone in the tradition of Scalia, regardless of looks and gender and all of that, that's going to be the most important.
I was going to ask Mike whether he knew this. Was Alex Kaczynski, I mean, is he still around in the federal judiciary, and was he on one of the lists?
I don't know if he's on the list. He's still a federal appellate court judge.
Okay.
One of the things, by the way, speaking about what Donald Trump can do, and then we're going to go back to calls, one of the things, a couple of weeks ago, we had Patrick Cotter here, who was a U.S. attorney in Brooklyn, the guy that got John Gotti. And we were talking about, it was in the wake of yet another murder in the city of Chicago, and I was asking, you know, what could be done to dramatically improve, you know, the federal, you know, fighting gangs and violence in the city of Chicago. And he suggested that that the Justice Department could adopt the same tactics they use going after, you know, RICO violations and going after street gangs in cities around the United States, which is exactly how they really cut into the mob in a big way. And I thought that was a good use of something that could be done within the Justice Department. And I'm wondering whether something like that would be something that Jeff Sessions could even give some thought to, because, again, you wouldn't expect that coming from someone from Alabama, but it could also have a dramatic impact on trying to reduce crime, which affects disproportionately African Americans in urban areas, of a bigger, broader issue of trying to just, you know,
right,
serve the African Americans with a Republican president.
Well, the interesting thing about that is the person who would be most able to do that would be Giuliani, because he was the master of RICO in the 90s, using RICO to infiltrate the mob. He set up a lot of those prosecutions, including using that to go after assets of dictators and so on. So the person who would probably be in the best position to creatively use those laws is someone like Giuliani.
But he's not the Giuliani. Exactly. He didn't pick Giuliani, which I think is fine. I mean, if there's a willingness to listen to that kind of advice from Giuliani, I think that that's the same as having. Well, I would be really concerned. I would have been very concerned to have Giuliani as Attorney General, just because of his background and many of the things that he did in New York that were considered problematic. But at the federal level, to use federal tools to try to get to this issue of gang violence in the inner city, I do think there is an opening.
I said this a few weeks ago on the program. Donald Trump has the ability to do a lot of Nixon-esque things, and I don't mean Watergate. I'm talking about the things that Richard Nixon did, coming from where he came from, that nobody expected him to open up China and to do all the things he did on the world stage because he was a hardline anti-communist.
Right.
So I'm just thinking, because Donald Trump is unpredictable, which we know. He is elected with fewer strings than any president that I can think of, certainly ideological strings. So we really don't know what we're going to get. So, I mean, if an attorney general from Alabama were to come up with a way to fight meaningful way, using the Justice Department to fight, you know, violence, you know, in the streets of America's inner cities, I mean, that would be a dramatic thing. That would be, my God, this is one of these shocker.
It would have to be in a meaningful way. I do think there's an opportunity there. And what I would like to see is close advising by those who are on the ground, who are in the city, who are fighting this fight.
Here's a question, and then we're going to take a call. Should President Trump, should he use sanctuary cities as an issue that it's a promise he made? Is that a promise he should keep, Bruno?
I'm trying to do away
with sanctuary cities.
I tend to be an immigration dove as opposed to many conservatives who are immigration hawks, and I think the answer is yes, he should. If there's one thing about sanctuary cities that's completely wrong, and it goes against the sanctuary cities are the flip side of wrong that the Supreme Court just ruled against with the state of Arizona. You can't have an immigration law and then just have a bunch of liberal city mayors and a left-wing government in a city say, we're just going to ignore this federal law. You just can't have it. There's either rule of law or there isn't rule of law. And the one thing that I agree with the immigration hawks on is that a situation where you just have a set of laws and ignore them, sooner or later you're going to have a breakdown that you have to fix because you can't have it.
And I also think this. He has this focus on inner cities. What are one of the biggest problems? Drugs coming over the border. He's made it very clear that his focus, first and foremost, in terms of going after immigrants, deportation, is against the hardened criminals. So those cities that are having huge inner city drug problems, that's exactly
where
you want to go.
That's not what the Democratic mayors are saying. The Democratic mayors still believe that Donald Trump wants to round up every illegal immigrant. He has been very specific for the last six months.
Has.
He's fine-tuned it. He had to fine-tune it. As far as I'm concerned, he doesn't fine-tune it enough.
Right.
And the illegal immigrants he's going after are those that have committed crimes while in the United States.
Yeah. There's no sanctuary for those.
He's been clear on that for months, and that's
yes,
also in his 100-day plan, and it's a fairly significant thing. And Who can disagree with that? People who shouldn't be in the country and have committed
crimes?
Everyone agrees with that.
The
news media does not make that fine point.
That's why he going over the heads of the news media with a video.
That's why I think someone like Rahm Emanuel will lose on
that. But part of the problem was that for the first three quarters of his campaign, it was not fine-tuned. And because of the blanket statements that he made about different groups of immigrants, and so that perception was cemented in the minds of so many.
A huge thing that's going on here, too, which may come into play, is that some of this crime in Chicago and other areas may be driven by the complete aggressiveness of the cartels, the drug cartels. And I've heard through various sources, that, you know, people talking about this stuff, that some of the stuff going on in the cities is some of the gangs breaking down.
That's right.
And fighting each other, while the drug cartels, and these are Mexican cartels, they're fighting each other all over Mexico right now, are coming in and taking advantage of some of these turf wars to actually take over territory.
Well, I will say, as someone who lives in the area where close to the heroin highway, that is actually a key factor in a lot of the violence that we don't actually talk that much about. It is the role of the cartel in the drug trade. The destruction of the gangs, or the dismantling of the gangs a couple of decades ago, actually led to also an increase in violence, because you saw the disruption of the structure, the hierarchy. People who actually respected the hierarchy in the gang system.
Yeah, right.
So when that dispersed, you saw it breaking up, and now you have block by block, you have different gangs who answer to no one.
That's
and
right.
That's it's just run
in honor among
in sanctuary cities, literally liberal mayors, they want to show their bona fides to the Hispanics that live in their constituency. And in the city of Chicago, Rahm Emanuel, who is the mayor here in Chicago, for those listening around the country, he has some serious political issues within the African-American community because of the way he handled a police shooting 2 years ago during his campaign, sat on a video that was very explosive. So really, and he was opposed by a leading Hispanic politician. And it was a very close race. So right now, the way I look at what Rahm Emanuel is doing is he's reaching out. I mean, there's no one that's going to be further left on sanctuary city. He wants to be the champion. He's going to fight Louis Gutierrez to be the champion of the Hispanic voters, because he needs those voters when he runs for re-election. And I do think he will run for re-election, because the African-American community at this moment in time, they're not going to be there for him.
And we just had, as of 2 days ago, the anniversary of the release of the Laquan McDonald video that really set off that firestorm. I do agree. I think this mayor, though, is a completely political creature.
Yes.
I don't know that he cares about the families that are the immigrant families in the city of Chicago, except to the extent that he can leverage this for his reelection.
Oh, yeah.
And I also think that the loss of Hillary Clinton, it is a lifeline to him.
Yeah.
And because Hillary Clinton did not win the election, I think that would have been his exit strategy out of Chicago.
Right.
And now that that didn't happen, he needs to make sure that he can keep this job. And so this is one of the things that he's hanging his hat on.
Right.
Michael?
Yeah, the point about the decapitating the gangs leading to more violence just goes to show sometimes you have to be very careful about how you choose to go about your law enforcement. That happened in Chicago and didn't work very well. As to Rahm, you know, Rahm is going to, you're right, he's going to dig in on this. But I think it's very important, if Trump is going to go against the sanctuary city thing, he also has to have on the carrot side, not the stick side. And here's what we're going to do affirmatively for these communities. But he seems to be working toward that.
But you've got to say, you've got to be specific. If you are the mayor of a sanctuary city, you get zero federal funding. Zero. That's what the federal government did to the South when local people didn't support the civil rights bills of the 60s and 70s. You get nada. Let's see how much pressure that would build on the mayor if Donald Trump did that. Back shortly from Chicago.
If you look hard enough, go off the beaten track far enough, you'll find an America teeming with the unusual, the odd, the downright strange.
I'm Will Klinger, and I'm your guide on a package tour we like to call
Wild Travels.
Join me for a new season of Wild Travels, Sundays at 10:30 p.m. on WTTW Channel 11.
The Museum of Broadcast Communications is Chicago's perfect place for senior citizens. Enjoy a stroll down memory lane. Reminisce as museum artifacts, photos, and classic TV shows trigger recollections from your childhood. Enjoy the TLC you'll receive from our expert tour guides. Discounts for groups of 20 or more. Schedule yours right now at museum.tv or call 312-245-8200. Plan your fun trip now at the Museum of Broadcast Communications.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. If you're watching us on television, this is about 6 weeks of a growth. I'm growing a beard for those on radio. I'm not so sure I like it. It played to split decisions with my grandchildren when I was in California last week. So I think I may keep it till December, keep the Santa Claus look, and then get rid of it. So if you hate it, another month maybe. Let's go to Greg listening to us in Schaumburg, Illinois, on our flagship station. Go ahead. You're on the air, Greg.
Bruce, we like you whether you have a beard or not.
Thank you very much.
And incidentally, now, this is going to be mainly to Lamara. I am from the Michael and the Stephanie side of the table. Bruce, Bruno being in a classification by himself, of
yes.
course. But, Amara, you are a fabulous new guest on this show. Terrific. Aww,
thank you.
Couldn't say anything more. And
I agree.
Would just like to just quickly add that before 4-7, you were talking about the inner city. Do not worry at all about Trump and his commitment to the inner city. It is going to be a passion. And it hasn't been brought up, the reason why I think that I'd like to put on the table. Trump has, by all counts, found a commitment to the Lord in the last 2 years. It's documented all over the place, and you're seeing that in terms of his ability to unify, almost Abe Lincoln-like-esque. And I think he really has the heart of those people in him, and he's going to really do something for them.
Well, I hope you're right, but I don't know whether I buy the religious side. But you know, you have a different view of mine than I do.
I think
he's a very practical politician, and like a good politician, he is running for re-election already. He wants to expand the base. He's looking where he didn't do well to try to improve it. And again, if he can improve his lot with African Americans, I mean, that could put him in good stead for re-election.
Somewhat to that. God Almighty knows the state of Trump's religious beliefs, okay? But I do think, and this seems to have evolved watching his speeches over the months of the campaign, he met people and went to places he never thought of. And he talked to people he never knew existed. He went to neighborhoods he didn't know existed. He met all these Southern evangelicals, people he probably never met in his life, who put their hands on him and prayed. That's a great video. He looks like he was in an alien spacecraft, okay? But I think he learned a lot more about America and a lot more about the people who live here. And I have to think he wants to try to do some positive things. Why else would he do? He's a 70-year-old billionaire. Subjectively, I think he wants to do a good job.
Amara?
I want to thank the caller for your comments. I very much appreciate it. And also to say that something does happen to you when you start to meet people when you're campaigning. I had this experience as well when I was campaigning. And when you hear people's stories, it does have the capacity to change you. It has the capacity to change your perception and to change even from what you were when you started that journey. And so that might actually be happening. I think that the opportunity that Donald Trump presents is a break away from the status quo. It is to move out of doing the same things that we know have not worked for so many in this country. The challenge, though, is getting over the fear of what his candidacy has meant to so many communities who feel and who have witnessed and experienced that it's emboldened a segment of the population that seeks to ride his coattails in order to push their agenda, their racist agenda, their homophobic agenda, or whatever agenda that they have. And that's where he's going to have to play a key role in tamping down on that element.
Well, and it's interesting you say that, because one of the things that my hope for him as, you know, as a Republican and as an American is that there are two things that he did on the campaign. And I really, really hope he continues to do them as president, especially when he's going to be locked up, locked away, cut off from everyday people because of the nature of the job. And that is, one, continuing this focus on the inner city and looking at different ways, creative ways to address those issues. We talked about some of them tonight. And the other one is continuing to have contact with the things that are affecting people in the heartland, in the middle of America. If anyone read the transcript of the New York Times op-ed, you know, the editor sit down, and I highly recommend that, he made it very clear that that was a huge part of a lot of his changes, and that was going to places he had never been before, staying away from New York, staying away from California. In a way, he said the Electoral College process is what made him a better campaigner. He went to places he had never been, had never met people, mm-hmm. and it it made him realize what was at stake. And that's what I hope he has a way of continuing to keep that contact, to keep his own personal fingers on the pulse with what's really going on in this country everywhere, not just New York and California.
Amar, I want to, because the caller referenced it, for those people who are seeing or hearing you for the first time this evening, give us a little background. Where are you from? You came to the United States, and you mentioned you ran for office. You had a short-lived campaign for mayor of Chicago.
I did.
But tell us a little bit about your background.
So I am a public policy consultant by trade, and I've worked in the top levels of city government. So I worked in the mayor's office under the Daley administration, very intentionally, because I wanted to really understand what was happening in the city, so many of the challenges that we face in education, economic development, housing, all of that. So I worked in city government. My background education, I have a PhD in educational policy studies, and then I have a law degree. And my focus from the University of Illinois at Urbana.
Okay.
And my law focus was more so on international law and affairs. So I live on the west side of Chicago, and I say I'm a west sider by way of the original west side, Nigeria. So, but I live in the community. I deal with the issues that we face every single day. And so a lot of my run for mayor was just feeling a sense of responsibility to make sure that we have the kind of transformative change in leadership that the city of Chicago needs and has needed, quite frankly, for decades. And so I did 2 years ago, actually about 3 days ago, was the anniversary of submitting my petitions. I ran for mayor and took it as far as I could. Didn't win, obviously. But
born here, or where were you born?
Born here.
Born
here.
Chicago?
But my parents were very politically active in Nigeria against the dictator that we had, and just for years. So we actually were not able to go back to Nigeria.
Will there be another run someday?
Very, very, very likely. Very likely. I can say that much.
Okay. All right. All right. Well, just remember, you got to come back and do this program.
Of course.
Right.
Because the current mayor was on the show for 8 years, and he's never come back, so too bad.
Oh. And the president.
Not good. And the president, too.
Oh, wow.
He's never come back either.
We'll have to change that.
Kevin, in Austin, Texas, listening to us on KLBJ. Go ahead, Kevin.
Hi, I've got a question. It's, who do you guys think is going to be the Department of Transportation? Now, the reason is, if he's going to have $1 trillion or whatever it is, and if he's a builder and he wants to get things actually done that will actually be shovel-ready, or implemented, who's he going to pick? I know he's looking at the Speaker of Utah, and also even, was it Ford's name has been thrown out there?
Yeah.
And would Mitt Romney be somebody who would be good at that, to actually get things built and completed like he did with the Olympics? I'll hang up and listen to your guys' answer.
All right.
I'm already on record at saying that Romney is really good at running almost everything. I mean, he's been brought in to fix things. And to the extent the transportation needs to be fixed, he would be a good policy fix, if not a good political one. I know a little bit about Harold Ford Jr., and he's pretty well respected in across the spectrum. But there's also a little bit, and this is just me commenting on it, there's a little bit of clearly a political aspect to that pick, which is not necessarily a bad thing. You have to make political picks. But he's also like a little bit of a, kind of like a show candidate for this, like, oh, look at what I'm doing. I'm picking someone from this side of the aisle who's doing this, that, and the other thing. I don't know how Harold Ford would operate the Department of Transportation. The fact is that almost anybody who turns out to be a really, really good manager can be a really good pick, and then someone who you thought was perfect could just be a crony who doesn't know anything about anything.
The question's Michael? That's a very astute question, though, because
yes.
If it's the case that there is really going to be a big construction
yes.
effort with $1 trillion, tens of thousands of jobs, the person in charge of that is going to be in the limelight to a degree that the transportation secretary usually is
right.
not.
Yeah.
Also, I got to figure, if Trump's an executive, he knows, as a senior executive, I can have my fingers on two or three maybe significant projects. I have to think that that's something he's going to personally have a heavy hand in supervising.
Right. I'm going to make a suggestion, and everybody's going to laugh, and the media will laugh. Chris Christie.
Except
he knows
bridge,
more about bridge building.
That's the first thing that came to mind.
He knows how to shut down the bridges. So.
No, but what about that? I mean, would that be a good choice or not?
I don't know what kind
of
too political.
Yeah,
a lot of baggage.
I think everything that happened to Chris Christie just shows that somebody who actually made a bold move to back Trump early and quickly kind of backfired on him. And I just I'd be one of the people who would guess that Christie's career. And yes, there's always second acts, and people may turn around, but the guy looks like the biggest loser right now.
Also, remember, right, they, Christie yeah. before the election was in charge of the appointments process, mm-hmm. and Pence went in, and Christie was fired because they had all these lobbyists in there, and that showed that he wasn't serious about Trump's program. Yeah. So I think Christie's got a bunch of strikes against him, as good as he may be.
Well, again,
otherwise.
It's about Christie. Christie's first. Christie's loyalist.
The first thing I thought was Bridgegate. I said, he's got Bridgegate. I think he does have too
much
baggage.
An experienced guy in transportation. He knows how to close the bridges. How can he build the bridges?
So we can clone Robert Moses and bring him back from the dead.
I want to ask this question, it's primarily to our Trump supporters. Have you lost friends because of this campaign, Michael?
I had some high levels of animosity that I intentionally ratcheted down, and I terminated conversations with people. One guy got so hostile, he's a close friend. I just called him on the phone after he put something on the internet that, you know, and I just said, "What in blazes are you doing?" And I was on the phone with him for half an hour, and I said, you know what, I just basically depoliticized my social media for like 2 months before the election. And I said, everyone knows what I think. Call me if you have a question, because I just simply didn't want to have that level of personal animosity anymore.
We got to pause. I'm Bruce Dumont. Back shortly. Don't go away.
The beauty of Amlink's interior landscape is that we can come in, work with your budget, and create a fit that makes sense for your facility at that time. Our goal is to create foliage designs that not only look incredible the day we put them in, but you can go back 2 years later and it is still maintained and has grown as a perfect fit for that customer's environment.
Call Amlinks now at 888-880-TREE.
A historic moment from the archives at museum.tv.
There can be no stable and enduring peace without the participation of the People's Republic of China and its 750 million people. That is why I have undertaken initiatives in several areas to open the door for more normal relations between our two countries.
Experience more history at museum.tv.
Let's come back. Let's continue our conversation. Yeah. We're talking about Hollywood and how the Hollywood stars basically are so out of touch, and they were all in one bag, and we were making jokes about some of them and whether or not they will actually leave the country.
And, you know, it's interesting because, you know, I have four teenagers, and it's this election has been a very good example of what, you know, maybe you need to look elsewhere, you know, not Hollywood, not movie stars or celebrities for your politics. And it's been a very interesting. But one of the things that you brought up before the break was the friends situation.
Yeah, I want to know whether you lost friends.
I wanted to address that because I did notice that, and I do not post things on my – I'm pretty apolitical because this is where I get to be political. You know, I don't have to – I like cat videos. And how many people just knowing that I was an R Republican, but not by anything I've ever posted because I'm very, very neutral on that, unfriended me, and especially after the election. And I know of I would say those first couple weeks after the election, Republicans I knew, just the vitriol with the postings and the comments, and a lot of people were very, very, nobody I know posted anything that said, "I'm proud that I voted for Trump."
You know, Scott Adams, the Dilbert guy, who had that very strange but ultimately correct assessment of how this thing would play out, said, "What Hillary's done with Trump is pure pure turning this guy into a monster. It was a 100% negative campaign. And the vestiges of that are people who maybe are a little naive or young or haven't seen lots of political campaigns. They really think this guy is like Adolf Hitler or something, and he's really not like Adolf Hitler. But they think, how could you vote for this guy? And they bought into some of this malicious, overly malicious depiction of this guy. It's going to take a while for that sentiment to leach out of the system.
On top of that, obviously I've been anti-Trump, so I haven't really had many liberals get mad at me for posting things. And I posted mostly negative stories about Hillary, but I would post stuff about Trump and why I didn't think he was going to win and so on and so forth. And I was wrong about that. What I find interesting was, or most interesting, was some of the pre-election stuff about the number of I've ended up with more troubles from conservatives who have unfriended me because I wasn't pro-Trump.
Oh, yeah.
And I look at that and I'm saying, okay, you're really, it's like, oh, well, you're for Hillary. It's like, no, I'm not for Hillary. That's preposterous. It's ridiculous. I'm just not for Trump. And, you know, so I've had those kind of unfriendings. And this is just where politics has gone. And for better or for worse, I mean, let's put it this way. I'm cautiously optimistic that with all of this thing cracked to pieces right now, the Jeb Bushes of the world cracked to pieces, the establishment cracked to pieces, the Clinton's gone, that maybe some level of reason can take place and people can sit there and talk to each other about various different things and say, oh, well, I didn't think it would turn out like this, and I'm pleasantly surprised that he's not Satan.
I hope that happens. Now, in your particular case, when you've been on this program almost consistently, you've been for Bernie Sanders. Actually, the first time you were on this program, you were part of the draft Joe Biden movement, and you were a substitute guest. And I would say you've been a very good job becoming our regular guest. But you're real strong pro-Hillary friends. Have you been unfriended by people?
I have not been unfriended by anyone. At least I don't think. I haven't checked in a while. I might have been. But I haven't been unfriended by anyone. I was never vocally I've always supported Senator Sanders for very principled reasons. And I've always been outward about my critiques of Secretary Clinton as well. But it hasn't caused anyone to unfriend me. Something that I've seen, though, come up in the weeks after the election is that people have recounted their experiences to me that they've had about Trump supporters after the win. So they would have in normal everyday interactions where someone would yell out of a car window or something, "Make America Great" or "Trump" or something derogatory. And you're seeing some of that, and that can be very traumatic. And I don't want to discount those kinds of experiences that a lot of people in the country are seeing. I even have seen a couple of things when I've posted about even with the most recent passing of Fidel Castro, and someone just randomly, "Well, Trump is going to make America great, and if you like it or leave it, or leave the country if you don't like it." Like those kinds of statements that I think are actually predominating and are becoming more commonplace. So it's going to take some time for the healing process. I think it's going to take time.
I have found that when I have posted things on my personal page, the reaction, just basically in being sort of trying to be objective about the coverage of a campaign or suggesting that Donald Trump had an opportunity to win, I mean, just by making, you know, journalistic assessments, they've automatically assumed that this is what I'm supporting.
Yes.
Now, later on, as it evolved, I think it was pretty obvious, you know, that I'm fairly happy with the results of the election. But I mean, the last week when I was in California visiting friends in Palm Springs and, you know, families in Hollywood who come out of the Hollywood community, I mean, it was cool. I mean, there was a coolness, and granted, you run into a few people out there that understand what it's about. But so I think this election, and obviously seeing, you know, thousands of people march outside, you know, Trump Tower, which I live nearby. Mm-hmm. So I mean, when you see this anger that's out there, I think you're right. I think both sides made the other sides look like boogeymen. I mean, the Trump people were doing the same thing to Hillary.
With this exception, though, she really de-emphasized an affirmative case for her own candidacy and just went after him, whereas he actually moved the other way and moved away from attacking her, and more as the campaign ended, talked about specific things.
Here's the telling thing. You know, where we live, our public high school sent out a note within the next day or two, a letter to all parents, and then a day later our private high school did that as well, and that is there were letters going out in droves from schools saying, we want you to know that our school, despite the election results, is a safe place where we value diversity or whatever. And my very smart 14-year-old son said, that's not for me. That is not to protect me if I'm a Trump supporter.
No.
And he figured that out right away, so people can wear their safety pins and have a safe place to feel bad that Hillary lost. But it was not there to protect any point of view that it could be good that Trump won.
Stephanie Hitt, Michael Lotus, Bruno Barron, Amara Enya, thank you all for being with us this evening. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks to Dan Dorfman and Colin Bobbitt and Fritz Goldman for their assistance in the production of this program. Until next week, this is Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.
Everyone loves vacationing in Florida. So why not experience it as it was meant to be? Where turquoise Gulf waters meet tranquil island beaches. Feel the powder-soft sand between your toes. Revel in a glorious island sunset. Shop the boutiques of a seaside village. Ride horseback along tranquil waters. This is Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Real, authentic Florida, where you can discover an intimate downtown and sip cappuccino at a sidewalk cafe. Catch fresh fish for dinner. Even tour a working winery. Just minutes from all the rest Florida has to offer. Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Plan your visit online at BradentonGulfIslands.com. That's BradentonGulfIslands.com.
The beauty of Amling's interior landscape is that we can come in, work with your budget, and create a fit that makes sense for your facility at that time. Our goal is to create foliage designs that not only look incredible the day we put them in, but you can go back 2 years later and it is still maintained and has grown as a perfect fit for that customer's environment.
Call Amlings now at 888-880-TREE.
If you look hard enough, go off the beaten track far enough, you'll find an America teeming with the unusual, the odd, the downright strange.
I'm Will Klinger. And I'm your guide on a package tour we like to call
Wild Travels.
Join me for a new season of Wild Travels, Sundays at 10:30 p.m. on WTTW Channel 11.
My name is Johnny Carson. My job is to make you laugh.
Johnny Carson brings you TV legends and classic moments every night.
Don't make fun of me, Johnny.
And now through October, don't miss Here's Johnny, the making of The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. It's a must-see collection of Johnny's stage props, costumes, video, and more. For more info and tickets, go to museum.tv.
A historic moment from the archives at museum.tv.
I did not have sexual relations with that woman. Miss Lewinsky, I never told anybody to lie, not a single time, never. These allegations are false, and I need to go back to work for the American people. Thank you.